Wednesday, February 17th, 2016, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, how the media covered the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Donations, journalists giving them and accepting them. We'll talk about the ethics of each. And it looks like there could be some revolutionary organizational changes coming to the BBC. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well before our half hour is up. But let's start with the latest round in the saga of University of Missouri Communications professor Melissa Click and her relationship with the news media, both here locally and across the country. I guess you could say the latest round started last Wednesday, when Click sat down for two extended interviews, one with Marissa Hollowett at KMIZ and one with KBIA News Director Ryan Familiner. One thing that came out of each of those, Click is now working with Status Labs, a reputation management firm based in Austin, Texas, which took on her case pro bono following her suspension. So Saturday morning, the Missourian published its interview. It's a 3,500-word profile that went into pretty great detail on all aspects of Click's life and what life has been like for her, her husband, and their children since November 9th. And about a third of the way through the piece, embedded in the text, is a YouTube video. It's about 3 minutes. It's 3 minutes and 18 seconds long. Excerpts from the police body cams during the protest at the homecoming parade back in October. The Missourian obtained that body cam video on January 21st, but chose not to run it until a fuller story could be told. And this was that fuller story. Missourian executive editor Tom Warover told me that the newspaper had a reporter working on a profile of Click for weeks before she broke her silence, and that that reporter had requested a copy of the video under the Missouri Sunshine Act, and there had been discussions going on and decisions made to hold the video until it could be released under a greater context. Do you feel that that was achieved?
I don't know. I mean, I'm going to say this up front. I have said before, and I'll say it again, I think the Missourian, along with some other local media, has done a really good job of covering the broad issues, covering Click. So what I'm about to say is not critical of their overall coverage, but the decision to hold that video until they could put it in context, I think, was a mistake. I think you can walk and chew gum at the same time. That was breaking news when they got that video, however they got it, whoever tipped them off to it. And they should have told that story. If it took another day or two to do the big contextual piece, so be it. I think they should have done both. But to bury that video in this, quote, bigger contextual piece, I think was a mistake.
I would agree with Mike. I applaud the Missourian and their coverage and the local media in general for the coverage they have. But I think holding that video to provide some context, a greater context, as Tom put it, I think it is somewhat of problematic because, as Mike said, you had the video. It does provide an additional piece of information. You could have put that out there within the context of the larger story of Melissa Click's actions on Francis Quadrangle, what the curators had made the decision that they made, Foley's comments that came right after she was charged, and then subsequently the decision by the prosecutor to sort of suspend her
to
sentence
defer the charges
to defer the charges and that sort of thing. So I mean, therein lies the proper context. This is one piece of a larger puzzle that could have been placed in there at the time. So context is something that you build, and even to this point, I don't think that we have placed this in the proper context.
And, you know, I guess I would also say, and it's easy to sort of Monday morning quarterback, but the Missourians should probably be a little more transparent about when they received the video. They don't have to reveal their sources, but I mean, they asked for the video after somebody tipped them off that the video existed. Maybe we all should have known as media that the police wear body cameras, and we should have thought to ask for the video sooner.
We covered it as local media when the Columbia police got the funding to buy them and begin using them in the first place. So we knew they had them.
But the thing, regardless, once they knew that this video existed and they had it, releasing it when they could have released it might have had an impact. Now, they could argue maybe it would have had the wrong impact on events that occurred after that, and yet we'll never know if we're holding on to something that's important to the public discourse. I agree that by itself, that video shouldn't lead to a decision about whether Melissa Click is fired or whatever, but it is important information for the public to have, and it shouldn't come buried in a story 2 or 3 weeks after they got it.
Yeah, that's the other issue that I have, is the fact that it is buried down into the story, and you have to
go
in, and
it's a third
of the way down, and it's sort of, there's sort of this two-sentence paragraph lead into it, and then you see the video, and you have to really carefully watch it for the curse mm-hmm. words that she's now being pummeled for by certain segments of both the legislature, and has also come under considerable I would say more pressure from the university administration. So now you've got what I would think is a different context than probably you would have had the Missourian released that video when they first got it.
I think it's interesting to speculate a little bit about the timing of all. I'm not saying speculate about the Missourians' motivation for the timing of it, but whoever leaked it to them, and the fact that this came out at a time when the chancellor was trying to kind of play it down the middle of the road, placating those opponents, but also saying we have processes we need to follow. Then the curator sort of took it out of his hands and decided to do their own investigation. One thing's pretty clear, though, that even though Melissa Click engaged finally in this rehab tour, so to speak, of talking to the media, this second video, fairly or not, gives the curators and the chancellors some pretty potent ammunition if they decide to do what they otherwise might not have done, which is to take quick action rather than delayed action on her.
Yeah, and I also think that, you know, now you've got a very different tone, but you do have a different tone in terms of what's happening now, because I think it was last week where the House had voted to not include Missouri in the 2% increase, but then you had some senators backtracking, saying things may change once the budget bill gets over to the Senate. Well, now you throw this into it, and now it's all in flux.
Well,
again,
and looking at some of the other parts of other interviews during the course of this media tour in the last couple of days, one of the questions that Jim Reek asked on KOMU, and you can see that full interview on our links blog as well. One of the questions Jim Reek asked of Melissa Click was, do you love the University of Missouri? Well, of course, yes. Well, do you love the University of Missouri enough to walk away from it if you find out that the state legislature won't fund the University of Missouri if you continue to be a part of it?
Yeah, it's interesting to me because I think all of these long-form interviews, the one that Jim Reek did, the one that Ryan Familier did for KBIA, the others, actually revealed some interesting things that the public ought to talk about with regard to this case. I mean, Melissa Click did reiterate her apology, says that she hopes she wouldn't be judged on an instance, or maybe two instances, of questionable judgment under duress. She also, however, did say in response to that question from Jim Reek that she thought maybe there was some election year politicking going on. She told Ryan Familier that maybe she didn't use the word victim, but she said that she's a convenient symbol or a target for the anger and sort of the easy conclusions that people want to draw about this case. So I think those interviews really did shed some light on a story that we ought to talk about.
And I think we need to do more than just talk about it. I think that it is incumbent upon the local media to actually begin to look at who are they actually talking about? I mean, they talk a lot about Melissa Click, but she was actually there trying to help students, students of color, who are feeling disenfranchised and victimized on campus. And that story has kind of gotten lost in all of this back and forth between the legislature, the university administrators, and Melissa Click. And now you have that being the story as opposed to what the story was at the beginning, which was dealing with these issues that are happening
on
campus.
How much of that is because that's easier than dealing with what the real problem is?
You can, despite the criticism we've expressed here about the Missouri, and see why, if the second video is once again drawing attention away from the bigger story, why the Missourian might have decided to want to put this in the larger context. I think there were a couple of other things about this story that were really interesting, too, this past week. One was, and I think you pointed it out, this mixed messages that the chancellor was sending.
Yes, and did you notice, too, you and I had talked about that privately yesterday morning, and then the Tribune had an article on just that yesterday afternoon.
And basically what we're talking about is that the chancellor sent out an email to all of us who are employees of the university, where he described her behavior in this second video as inconsistent with that which is expected of a faculty member. Okay. What he said in the comments that were sent out to the news media, that he was appalled by what she did.
And angry. And angry. Use the word angry as well.
And why? Now, that's interesting.
And now that email has caused a lot of conversation here on campus about what is his role in this. I mean, according to the collective rules and regulations of the university, there's a process that must be followed. And faculty were already upset about the fact that they felt and still feel that the curators were not following that policy. And now with the interim chancellor basically saying that he's going to go and talk to the curators about this latest video, that now they're saying, well, wait a minute, now he's basically not following those collected rules. So it's as I've said, it's all going back to Melissa Click and whether or not these rules are being followed, and not what the I don't want to say original story, but the other story, which is the students themselves and what they had said they wanted to see happen. And all of that has sort of gotten lost in this sort of dialogue surrounding Melissa Click.
I thought it was pretty interesting, too, how she says, and I believe her, that she was approached by this reputation management firm out of Texas rather than going out and hiring her. But regardless, it's interesting in this day and age that there is a business called reputation management because of all the stuff that's out there in social media. And they basically assured her that they were going to work to get, when you searched her name on Google, that eventually you'd see positive information about her and not just the video and the other criticisms.
Yeah, and I was a little surprised by the fact that, you know, the Missourian's video came out with that story that talked about this image reputation. And it sort of dawned on me, well, wait a minute, why did that firm not know about this video?
Why didn't they in their work also request it under the Sunshine Act, under Freedom of Information?
All the information they could possibly get.
Right, so that they would have all of that at their disposal, too, to be able to protect against it.
Right.
And could I just raise one other thing before we leave this topic?
Please do.
It's sort of the broader question. Yes. So here we have police body camera video being used the way it was. And I think we've talked many times about how it's great to have the body cameras and the dashboard cameras. And a lot of activists believe that this is going to help us to hold police more accountable for their activities, especially with minority residents and others. Okay, it does that. And I'll be curious to see if in the future, if the Columbia Police Department would so quickly release body camera video if there's something critical of the police department when people come and ask for it. But the other thing about it is this, how many of us really could, and I'm not standing up for Melissa Click necessarily, but how many of us really want to be exposed to 24/7 surveillance on video where everything we do, good, bad, and ugly, can be reflected in the public record?
It's most definitely Orwellian.
And it's coming. There's a really interesting book that you ought to read, and it's called The Circle. It's by Dave Eggers. It's a novel, but it gets at this whole notion of sort of the logical next steps of video everywhere all the time connected to the internet.
It almost sounds like an episode of Black Mirror. Well, the media business is a business indeed, and it's one in flux. and never has that disruption been more evident that when word leaked that there's about to be a major structural overhaul at the BBC, we don't know the full details of what's going to be changing yet and likely won't until about the Easter holidays. But Mike, tell us what we seem to be learning so far through some of these leaks.
Well, so far we're being told that the director of the BBC is going to basically eliminate the separate radio and television divisions and management structures in the BBC and bring them together around content and audience. You know, that makes perfect sense in the age of mobile and internet media
and
all
that. It sounds like what we're saying to prospective students walking right past both of our offices every day.
It really does, but it also is in response to a conservative government in Great Britain basically saying, we're going to be cutting the funding of the BBC. And the BBC is a lot of things. It's the world's radio station. It's a global news organization that a lot of people respect. It's also a huge top-heavy bureaucracy that has a lot of layers of management. And theoretically, some of the people who are going to be let go under these changes are not going to be frontline journalists. They're going to be managers of all these different units that are going to be consolidated. If that's truly what happens and they don't cut into the muscle of the BBC's reporting, hey, good for them.
Yeah, that would be my concern, is the fact that, you know, the BBC is renowned for its ability to cover the world like it's
the gold standard.
Exactly. And my concern, and this is something that when I spent a summer in London, they were talking about this, especially in the tabloids, about the fact that the BBC was just too top heavy. And that's where a lot of the money was going, and that needed to be cleaned up. So in seeing this, I'm not surprised that this is happening, but I do fear as you said, Mike, that in this cost-cutting move, or in this move to restructure, that some of that worldwide news operation is going to be lost.
I will say that there are a lot of people in the BBC who are very forward-thinking and who are trying to do new kinds of journalism. And at the risk of kind of tooting our own horns, we're working with them.
Toot away.
We're working with them this semester, actually, a group of students, to figure out how they can take these different regional editions. They publish content and target it differently at different parts of the world. We're trying to help them figure out, through using the data they're getting back from those users, what's the right kind of content and how to place it to reach those different global audiences as effectively as they can. And I think that shows some signs that the BBC, despite all of its top-heavy management structures, really does want to be a part of the future of journalism.
Okay, well, Saturday afternoon, I was taking a pretty good nap and then rolled over, flipped on the TV, and there it was. Supreme Court Associate Justice Antonin Scalia had died suddenly. We know now his body was found on a West Texas ranch following what appears to be a heart attack. He was 79. And before the clock had even struck 4 p.m. here in the Midwest, tributes and remembrances from the right and the left, and they even actually kind of continue to flow in now, like this one from Stephen Colbert Monday night.
Not a lot of people laughed in the front row. Some people laughed in the back of the room, but the important people in the front row and on the dais, it was mostly silent while I gave the speech. And while I had a good time giving the speech, when it was over, no one was even making eye contact with me. Now, the one exception was Antonin Scalia. When I was making jokes about him, because what had happened was that he had been caught by photographers about a week before the dinner doing this to the photographers. So I did this to him, Jim. I did this to him while he was... I did my gestures at him, and after it was over, he came up to me. Again, no one is talking to me in the whole damn room. And Antonin Scalia comes up to me and said, "It's great, great. Did you give me one of these? Ah!" And I said, "Sir, first I want to ask, would that be legal for me to do?" And he goes, "Of course it would be legal." And I said, "Well, then, yeah, I gave you one of these." And he goes, "Great stuff, great stuff. Good night." And then he left. And I watched him go, and I thought, "Don't you make me love you, old man." So I will forever be grateful for that moment of human contact that he gave me.
So some gestures that were not so much to be shared in good company. It was, what, about 6, 7, 8 weeks ago that we were actually talking about some of Scalia's comments during the Texas affirmative action case, wondering exactly what it was that he meant when he said that perhaps black students might fare better at slower track schools. He really did have a knack for using language. in a way that made people pause, think, and on some levels even connect with those very different than him.
I mean, I would say one of the key things about Scalia mm-hmm. is that the general public didn't know about originalist law mm-hmm. or a strict constitutionalist until Scalia. I mean, he had a way of breaking that down and actually explaining, this is what I mean when I say that the Constitution is the Constitution as it was written by our fathers, and that's the way we should follow it. Now, there are plenty out there, including myself, who don't necessarily agree with that, but I think he was effective at basically showing the public this is what that meant.
I think, too, it says a little something about, and I don't really believe so much in the great person theory of history, that any one individual can, you know, change things. It changes bound to happen because of social trends and all that. But here's one person who, at the very least, made a huge change in sort of the legal philosophy of our court system. And even more, it turned this presidential election around on a dime. And
it
now this
sure
is
did.
The
and,
issue.
And it was even before that 4 o'clock, you know, as those tributes were coming in, by 4 o'clock, it was changing the entire narrative of the political campaign, of what 2016 is going to look like. It was the very first thing talked about Sunday night during the GOP debate.
I mean, that's the one issue that I have. I mean, the fact that we were still trying to track down exactly what happened out with Justice Scalia in West Texas, and the media had already flipped to
already,
who's going to be the successor, how is this going to impact the election, that sort of thing. I mean, I was going like, whoa, wait a minute, the man's not even, don't even know how he died.
That could have waited until Monday. It really could have. To start the handicapping that quickly felt a little cold to me.
I have to say, though, and speaking of knowing how he died, there's one aspect of this whole story where I think the traditional media have been complicit, but social media has been the driver, and I wish they weren't. This whole conspiracy theory business about, oh, he was found with a pillow. Was it on his face or over his head?
Yeah.
With somebody trying to kill him?
Yeah.
And, of course, Donald Trump couldn't wait to go on Michael Savage's radio show on Monday and hint at this conspiracy. Let's just let this stuff go. A great man died of natural causes. Let's talk about the impact on society and politics and leave this crazy nutcase stuff to the side.
Yeah. Okay, so my entire career, I have been told there are certain things we give up when we sign on to be journalists. We give up the right to protest. We give up the right to be advocates. We give up the right to publicly support political candidates. Today, that view is considered by many to be old school. It's considered to be a false objectivity that we do all hold biases, and instead of trying to hide them, we should simply be transparent and put them out there. It's under that premise that Gawker Media editor John Cook told reporters and editors that his employees are free to make political donations or make donations to political campaigns, but he wants staffers to disclose it when reporting on those campaigns or on the opponents. I read Cook's memo, and I invite all of our listeners and viewers to do that as well. It's on our links blog. It kind of made me want to take a shower, frankly, when I read it. But what did you guys think?
I'm gonna be a traditionalist. I don't.
So you're right there with me.
I don't think that journalists who are covering political, I don't think journalists, period, should be giving funds to political candidates or to political causes, especially if you're going to find yourself in a position where you're going to have to cover that issue or you're going to have to cover that candidate, because it does open it up to conflict of interest and people questioning whether or not you are being accurate in your coverage of the particular issue of the candidate.
So Mike and I, sitting here as you're saying this, we look like a bunch of bobblehead dolls going, uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh. But, you know, Cook is saying that he doesn't believe that it's a conflict of interest. He calls it a confluence of interest, that if you make no claim of objectivity, that it doesn't much matter.
Yeah, so I'll plead guilty to being the bobblehead. We'll make it three for three. I'm a traditionalist too. Not because I disagree with him that you can't set aside your biases or even your contributions and write a fair story, but it's still the perception of the conflict of interest. It's what the audience believes about us. I mean, you know, we talked about George Stephanopoulos not that long ago, gives $75,000 to the Clinton Foundation, doesn't disclose it, and he's the guy who was going to lead the political coverage of the presidential campaign.
So,
you can't do that.
So let me ask you this, because this Gawker thing hasn't received nearly the the press, if you will, people aren't talking about it at that same level as they did when it was Stephanopoulos. Is that because it's the Clinton Foundation, or is that because we're talking about somebody who's more mainstream? It's more of a media outlet of record, if you will, than Gawker.
No, I think it's because we've entered an era where this is what the public expects. They almost believe that journalists are out doing these things. They're giving to political candidates, they're giving to various issues, that they're biased in one direction or the other, that there's no, I guess you would say, for lack of a better term, middle of the road journalist who just says, this is the information and we're presenting it to you. That's all gone out the window. So I think that's where a lot of this is coming from.
I think there is a little bit to your question about whether or not we treated Stephanopoulos differently because he's
standard.
A mainstream media journalist and Gawker's more point of view journalism. Yeah. On the other hand, one could argue Gawker has every bit as much influence, if not more so,
probably
with
more
younger
so.
Voters.
Yeah.
And frankly, despite their coming out, riding out on their high horse saying we're putting out this policy, they did it after the International Business Times wrote a story saying there are lots of journalists
naming
who are giving money, and one of theirs gave $500 to Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. So. To me, this just contributes to what the public already perceives, and that is that there's just no unbiased journalism when it comes to politics.
So let me turn the tables on you. How do we feel about it when the Covered makes donations to the Coverer? Here's the context. The New York Rangers hockey team made a $5,000 donation to the GoFundMe account set up for Associated Press hockey reporter Ira Podell. Podell had been a regular on Press Row at Madison Square Garden until last spring when a brain tumor and stroke left him fighting for his life. The NHL Players Association, the union that the hockey players belong to, they also kicked in $2,000. So is this a nice gesture, a thank you, or is it an inappropriate gift?
I think this is a nice gesture. This is someone who covered them. He's not covering them now. The prognosis doesn't look good for him to be coming back. But I think this is a different kind of donation and a different issue than what we were just talking about.
I'd agree with that, especially since he's not covering them at the same time he's getting the money. I will say, though, there's also this different relationship for good and for bad, and we've talked about it on the show before, between most journalists covering a source and getting something from them and sports journalists who are routinely in bed with the teams they cover. So I think most people expect the relationship to be different, and in this instance, it probably excuses the donation and casts it in the light of just being a good gesture.
Okay, so this next topic, we may not have a whole lot of time to talk about. So I'm going to set it up. And if we don't, then suggest people go to our links blog to learn more. There was a fascinating investigation in the Chicago Tribune this past week, shared pretty widely on social media, looking at deadly drug interactions doctors and pharmacists often miss. For the general public, it's a scary look at how vulnerable we are every time we walk into a doctor's office. But for journalism nerds like us, it's a great study and a different way to engage investigative journalism. Sam Rowe wrote about the watchdog team's approach for the Columbia Journalism Review, describing an idea he calls ambitious, connecting journalists with top scientific researchers with access to data, in his words, to find answers, make discoveries, and invent new things. It's an interesting approach and a bold one for sure.
This is easy for me. It's an excellent idea. I mean, journalists need help from scientists and other experts in interpreting data. I think we can tell really good and useful stories with it. And frankly, I think that it's a time when the public really doesn't trust science. Journalists can help to explain science to a way that makes it relevant to people.
Yeah, I also think that journalists can take this sort of journalism outside of science and look at other issues, social issues, in the same way. Go to experts, work with them to try to come up with some solutions as opposed to just the back and forth, this is what the issue is.
Okay, well, that music means we're out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about the topics we talked about on our links blog on it's on KBIA.org under the programs tab. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonKBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments, questions, see what we'll talk about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show. Maya Jackson is our technical director. Pat Akers handled the audio, and C. Chen is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you next time.